The Guardian.
Hello, I'm John Plunkett and welcome to Media Talk. On this week's show, BBC Two goes back to the future with modern times. Plus, Maria Miller gets tough with Google and Facebook over explicit content on the web. Channel 4 launches its second screen app. And that Rhys Ifans interview in The Times. Was it the worst ever? And we talk Game of Thrones and the Americans with The Guardian TV editor Rebecca Nicholson. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. And on this week's show, I'm joined by Mr. Jason Deans, editor of Media Guardian, and by broadcast editor Lisa Campbell. Welcome both.
Hello. Hello.
And before we start, I've got to ask, have you checked your privileges?
Always.
I've spell checked my privilege, because it's a hell of a word, isn't it? And I think I-L-E-G... Well, anyway, right. First up this week, BBC Two is going back to the future by reviving its Modern Times documentary strand. The observational documentary series, or docu-soap if you prefer it that way, was axed by the then BBC Two controller Jane Root in 2001. Fast forward 12 years, aka the present day, and it's back, with current controller Janice Hadlow saying it walks softly and carries a big gun. Lisa, I think I know what she means by that. I think it's a big stick, isn't it? But she went for the gun.
Yes. Bit violent, I think.
I like Modern Times. I think it's a good thing. Is it a good thing it's coming back? It's a good thing.
I think it is. I think it's a great example of television going full circle. I mean, the strand was axed by Jane Root, as you say, because it was seen as a straitjacket and that documentary makers needed more flexibility to produce standalone single films. And they could act as mini explosions, they were described as in the schedules. And I think this is a recognition that nowadays it's very difficult to be noticed as a standalone single film, let alone be a mini explosion. So I think you've got the benefit of the marketing and publicity that goes with a strand. I think it'll be good news for documentary makers and welcome news. I think that, potentially an area of concern is that in the past it was very much a strand for upcoming directors and young directors, and they were really given the freedom to tell their stories and to produce very authored and distinctive films. And the suggestion is that times have really changed and directors aren't really being afforded that freedom anymore. And it's actually a focus of debate at the Sheffield Dockfest next week. So Directors UK have said, this has been an issue for a couple of years amongst factual directors, that concerns that edit producers are now sort of sitting there cutting the rushes instead of the director. And it's all to do with time and budget constraints. So there's a big question there around that. Will they have the freedom that they were afforded in the past?
So the brand name might come back, but the quality possibly not. Yeah, Jason, were you a Modern Times viewer back in the day? What do you remember of them?
I think it was very. I watched some of them. I probably didn't watch that many. This was a time before we had Sky Plus and things. I think it was very much a creature of its time. I think it was introduced in the mid '90s to replace 40 Minutes, and it was very. I think to take a more arch postmodern. For want of a better word, look at things. And you do, I personally certainly do remember it for that sort of mid-90s era. And I do wonder whether bringing it back, I think, having a documentary strand for all the reasons Lisa was explaining is a good idea. But bringing back that particular, Modern Times, that particular brand, I don't know, because, the times have changed. I think it was very much of its time. So I wonder about that.
Yeah, they were sort of more innocent times, weren't they, in a sense? And people were maybe I'm deceiving myself. Maybe in those days, back in the 90s, people were less self-aware and less aware they're on TV. So, for instance, I remember the Lido, the documentary in Brockwell Park Lido in South London, where you got some fantastic footage. But would you get that today, or would people be really aware of the cameras there and play up to them and think, I'm going to become a star?
Yeah, I think it's become a lot harder for programme makers now to get the sort of authentic response from contributors, because they are so aware of the cameras and they think that they're playing up the story. They're familiar with things like Jeopardy and everything that the TV producer's looking for. So I think you just have to hope that you've got very good programme makers that can get around that. And because I do think there's a real need for distinctive documentary making now, particularly with the raft of sort of documentary series that we've been seeing, where they are very heavily formatted. I mean, even right down to the music. And a personal bugbear of mine is the sort of Baltic Irish theme tune that was used in Big Fat Gypsy Wedding. So it was composer Ian Livingstone. And now you hear that everywhere, whether it's, Sewing Bees or The Undateables. It's just this sort of formula. And I think what's interesting and exciting potentially about Modern Times is that it won't be formatted like that you will generally get that very distinctive voice coming through.
Oh, yes. We mentioned the Sewing Bee, Jason. Sewing Bee coming back to the Great British Bake Off alike, coming back to BBC Two, as is Bake Off, as is a series about Iceland. And we had Greggs on Sky, and now we've got a series about Iceland on BBC Two. I wonder, who'd have thought that, you know, what's the polite phrase? Budget high street food retailers would be such a rich source of TV material right now.
It's hard not to suppress a truck chuckle when you see that. But it all depends on, you know, who they've got. You know, and then the execution, isn't it? And presumably they've found. I mean, if you look at the BBC Three series, the call centre, you know, which seems to be they seem to have found the real life David Brent, you know. So it will be
and a big sort of, hit, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Malcolm Walker is the character. He's the guy that heads up Iceland, and he is the character that you're talking about that you really need in those shows. And I mean, I've interviewed him a couple of times, and he's just absolutely brilliant. You know, you'll get the sound bites that you're looking for. So I'm looking forward to that actually.
When did you come across the Iceland Man on Broadcast Magazine?
No, when I was on Marketing Magazine, actually,
right.
Yes.
Right. I say he hasn't got a radio station or a TV channel.
Not yet.
We will have by the end of this. Yeah, yeah. We'll certainly have probably a different agent. Anyway, but sticking with BBC Four for a minute, there's a vacancy at the top of that channel. Janice Adlow is currently overseeing Four on an acting basis, and suggestions, Lisa, that there might not be a full-time controller appointed, or if there is, then it'll be sort of slightly lower grade than it was when Richard Klein had the job, and that maybe Janice will have an overarching role encompassing both.
Yeah.
I think I've got that right in a rather long-winded way.
I think it makes sense because the budget has been cut so much. I mean, it's about 30%, taking it down by 10 million to 26 million, which is not big for a whole channel. So there is less work to do, effectively. But I think Danny Cohen, the new director of television, his big thing is collaboration. And I think there's been concerns in the past that it hasn't really been the team spirit it needs to be, that sort of team of controllers. So I think by having Janice Hadlow overseeing BBC Two and overseeing Four will help just, I think, be more efficient, and just someone having that kind of creative overview, and having a channel editor, a sort of, you know, sort of more junior position overseeing things. I think that totally makes sense. And it also, you know, it'll please the Daily Mail, money-saving opportunity.
Ticks all those boxes.
Yeah.
And Jason, it kind of feels like there could be more synchronicity between the two channels in the way that ITV and ITV2 have spin-offs of Britain's Got Talent and whatever, when BBC2 next does Stargazing Live or Airport Live, which is coming up. I'm very excited about, with Dan Snow.
Excited about that.
I am, yeah. That could be a crash. Airport Live. They can have more Airport Live. What would it be? Takeoff Delayed. I don't know. On BBC4, which we don't really have at the minute.
No, absolutely.
Plus one programmes, as it were.
Yeah, although I think the way it's gone, isn't it? I think it's probably it's sort of art and history and archive channel. So, you know, Airport, I mean, that's probably maybe a BBC Three thing. But, I mean, possibly, yes. I mean, in terms of if collaboration is the way they're going. And you can also already see in radio they've done this where, you know, Bob Shannon is in overall charge of Six Music. So they follow a similar model. And, you know, it seems to make sense. In an era when they're looking to cut costs, the job isn't what it was creatively. It's not as big a draw as it was.
So. Not as when you originate an hour, it's on Four, and neither on Two. I said to Janice,
absolutely.
You know, well, you're having a tough time in daytime at the minute because. And she said, well, we haven't got daytime anymore. You know, which is a frank admission, but it isn't. Is it? It's just it's repeats and archive.
Yeah. And it's interesting. The last biopic that's going to be on BBC Four is the Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor drama, which has a fantastic cast. You know, with Dominic West and Helena Bonham Carter, and you do wonder why that isn't on Two anyway.
Yeah, they're certainly going out with a bang, but yeah, there'll certainly be a big audience for that. I imagine that will be their last one and probably the biggest audience.
Mm.
Well, sticking with the BBC, more now on the corporation's Digital Media Initiative fiasco, or DMIF for short. The £100 million project was scrapped by Tony Hall after it became obvious that it wasn't going to work, and the corporation, he said, had wasted a huge amount of licence fee payers' money. It's now been claimed that BBC Trust Chairman Lord Paton was warned a year ago that the DMI, as it was then, was doomed to fail by Bill Garrett. This was back in May 2012. He's a former head of technology, I think, at the BBC. And the scheme to create a tapeless future for the whole of the corporation was axed, and the BBC's chief technology officer, John Linwood, suspended. Jason, it feels like this story sort of gets worse and worse for the BBC.
It's not great, is it? And you know, whenever you hear the words BBC and technology project, I mean, they always, you know, it's sort of a litany of disasters, really. They just don't seem to be able to get them right. I mean, in some ways, there are perhaps parallels with the archive project. You know, to start with, it just seems like, you know, too ambitious, really. The aspiration was laudable, but, you know, to move to a tapeless video content management system. The ambition was, you know, it was a bridge too far, or several bridges too far. And then it comes back to, yes, to questions about the oversight of it, financial oversight, and whether they should have stepped in earlier or whether they should have scaled it back. So, yes, Bill Garrett says that he contacted the trust a year ago to warn them about, you know, that it was heading for the rocks and that they took no notice. So, and it also puts more pressure on Chris Patton, you know, who didn't come out of the whole Savile scandal particularly well, you know, about his competence, really.
Yeah, but MPs, well, particularly Tory MPs, I think Philip Davis, at least, have been saying, you know, Patton again, sort of a sleepwalking trust, you know, not a hands-on enough, and going back to this idea that, you know, they're neither a proper regulator and not really a proper champion either.
Mm. Well,
back to governance, his favourite topic.
Yeah, well, $100 million is a shocking amount of money to lose like that, and I think the fact that Patton knew about this, there were a lot of concerns about it at the time, you know, a year ago, is outrageous, really, and it should have been dealt with. And at least Tony Hall has taken swift and decisive action and just said, right, end it now and stop wasting any more money. But shocking.
You wonder how much money you have to spend before you realise it's not going to work. You know, when it got to sort of good topic for a fly on the wall documentary, maybe, you know, when it got to sort of 75 million, was it like, well, come on, lads, let's give it another 25 million. I think we can break this thing.
Because I think that, well, at the moment, yes, the interesting question is how much did they spend between the warnings last summer and, you know, actually realising, yeah, this is a dead duck.
Yeah, yes. As I discovered in my garden last week, when you're in a hole, stop digging. And also this week, away from the BBC for a change, because we do non-BBC stories, Channel 4 has revealed details of its much-anticipated, well, it certainly is here, second screen app. It will launch in July to the broadcaster's 8 million or so registered users and will enable them to take part in real-time votes, games and quizzes. Plus, advertisers will be able to target them with interactive content synced with the ads that are appearing on screen. So there'll be two lots of commercials you can ignore and fast forward through. Lisa, why is this so important to Channel 4?
Well, Channel 4 is all about engaging with the 16 to 34 audience particularly, and that's where they're at online. And so it's about how it's going to engage with those viewers. It's about collecting data, and so the advertisers can be more targeted in their advertising. And it's interesting that they've got about 6 million people who have signed up to the online Channel 4, and they're going to target them first with this. So almost creating this kind of club that, you know, you get the first access to this and then they'll be rolling it out. So I think it's quite savvy. I think it's, you know, it's user-friendly. It's quite annoying having to download separate apps for separate programs, and then you lose the audience in between the show. I think just having one central place is a brilliant idea, and you know, I think more people should do it.
And Jason, this is a big initiative of Channel 4 chief executive David Abraham is putting a lot of stead by this, but it seems to me the problem is that you know, people have already got a social media platform they can go onto, Twitter, which isn't, you know, which isn't sort of owned by Channel 4 in a sense. They've kind of got to break that down and encourage people to come to a, you know, a broadcaster owned app, which might be difficult, but Abraham's very enthusiastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think and Channel 4, you know, ahead of the game on this. I think, you know, it's something David Abraham flagged up when he came in as a thing he was going to focus on. He said that audience data was going to be the big, you know, on the big areas. So that's why they started the registration through 4OD and their website. And then, yes, and then, you know, this is another phase in trying to get, you know, using second screen to get, you know, to get closer engagement. It's almost like a membership club. So, you're more closely engaged with the channel and with the channel's programming, and I believe research shows that if you're tweeting about a program or an ad, you're more likely to engage in terms of clicking through and, you know, e-commerce, buying things online. I think they're looking at all sorts of opportunities like that.
I think the commercial side of things is one story, and perhaps that's the most interesting thing as far as Channel 4 is concerned at the moment. But I do think that broadcasters are missing a trick in terms of the editorial benefits of second screen. And, you know, there's £1 million drop, which is a great example, but there are not many others where there's examples of real innovation. And I think, you know, having something in the future where one of the chairs on The Voice can be controlled by, you know, people at home via Twitter, so you can tweet to make the chair turn.
But you could extend that to News at 10 with Hugh Edwards, for instance, just, you know, halfway through, keep him on his toes. But yeah, it feels to me that the extent of a lot of broadcasts of second screen, Jason, is just, you know, hashtag Ignify on Have I Got News For You, for instance, or hashtag Question Time. That's about it. But that in itself is incredibly simple, but quite valuable in that it can drive viewers to your TV show if you get it trending early enough and your transmission time. I'm sure people like WPP will be able to show that with their analysis.
I think it's an area that so your Twitter is already, you know, marketing itself. One of the questions about Twitter has been, you know, it's great, you know, old world, certainly everybody in media land uses it, but how is it going to make money? But I think it's now marketing itself as a platform or as a way that advertisers or broadcasters, particularly advertisers, you know, marketing people can get, you know, a more direct relationship with the audience. So they throw, you know, so there's figures like apparently 60% of UK users tweet while watching TV, 40% of all Twitter traffic in peak time in the evening is about television. You know, so there is clearly a very symbiotic relationship, but everybody's just trying to work out, as Lisa was saying, you know, editorially, there's, you know, a lot more that can be done. But I think it's in its early days, but we're going to see a lot more of this, I think.
Right, and finally this week, it's time to move to The Times, where actor Rhys Ifans didn't exactly see eye to eye with Janice Turner, his interviewer. It ended with Ifans, you'll remember him from films such as Notting Hill and other stuff, telling her to fuck off, adding, "I want to end this interview now, I'm bored with you, bored, bored." That's Ifans speaking, not me. Now, I got to say, I had a troublesome hour in a hotel room with Jay Middlemiss once.
haven't we all, John?
The memory burns bright. I'm sure it does for her too. Went back to the Radio Times. They said, "Was there an angle?" I said, "Probably not." But first up, Lisa, did you see the interview and anything to compare in your media career?
I did once interview an American director who was about 7 feet tall, or so he seemed. He was massive, and I think he used to be a basketball player. And he was very unhappy at my question about his influences and you know, his inspiration. And he said, you know, "What kind of stupid question is that? What inspires me? How dare you ask what inspires me? My dog." And that was that. And from that point on, it was pretty much over. That was about 10 minutes in, so not good.
Oh my God, how'd you recover from that? Yeah.
Well, and that was on film as well. So actually, interestingly, in the same way as Janice, we sort of turned that into our advantage and we edited it to make him look like the idiot he was. So,
and let's hope he's listening.
Yes.
Well, Jason, that's a good point in the sense that better a terrible interview than a sort of, you know, slightly mediocre rambling one.
Absolutely. Yeah. The whole sort of press junket thing, it just sort of highlights, you know, if you catch the act, you know, actor in the wrong mood, then it can all disintegrate fairly quickly. I mean, I think it was obviously the whole process was spoofed in Notting Hill, wasn't it? Quite, you know, a few years ago. So everybody, well, journalists and PR, you know, we all know what the game is, but, you know, obviously it relies on particularly on the talent to play the game. And and then sometimes when they don't, as in this case, then the results are more entertaining anyway for the reader, probably. But
I had a tough encounter with a certain Radio 2 DJ who, in fact, the interview never came to pass after it was put to him that he might want to chat to me. And I think he just sort of dismissed me in a four-letter word, Jason. But I think he got me confused with someone else, possibly. Well, I like to think so.
Really?
Naming no names on the part of the DJ or the person he might have got me confused with. But any tough gigs, Jason? Your back catalogue?
My back catalogue? Well, yes. Well, it's quite a long time since I... I did any interviewing, but I on my one and only press junket to LA, for reasons which probably will become apparent, I was interviewing Matt LeBlanc on the set of his long-lost sitcom, Joey, and I knew things were going badly when he started taking the piss out of my shorthand, that my career as a celebrity interviewer sort of came to a juddering halt there, really. But
it's interesting, isn't it, how, you know, we're blaming Rhys, but I do think we don't know the full story, do we? Because the interviewer could have been quite annoyed at the fact, and rightly, I can see how this is irritating, at the long list of things you can't talk about, and so might have gone in there a bit grumpily, and, you know, he's picked up on that, and they just haven't gone on off to a very good start. So, you know, I do think that part of your job as a journalist is to soften people up and get things out of them when they, you know, they don't want to talk, and that includes their attitude. And if they're a bit grumpy, then, you know, talk them round.
Well, send us your disaster interviews, or let us know about them on the Media Talk blog, of course, or you can tweet me at JohnPlunkett149. But for now, my thanks to Lisa Campbell and to Jason Deans.
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, Gary Young writes that hypocrisy lies at the heart of the trial of Bradley Manning, and George Monbiot gives a very personal reaction to the murder of April Jones. Also in our audiobook review, we examine appetite with Lionel Shriver's novel Big Brother and Jay Rayner's exploration of the food industry, A Greedy Man in a Hungry World.
To subscribe for free to the Guardian audio edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud, iTunes and Audioboo. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
It's time to talk technology now, and I'm delighted to say I've been joined by none other than The Guardian's head of technology, Jemima Kish. How are you?
That's a finely honed radio voice you've got there, John Plunkett.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I pronounce Little.
Little.
And the Beatles.
Yeah, which is fine if you're talking about Rod Little, but not any other time.
And first up this week, Jemima, Maria Miller, I see here, Culture Secretary, is getting tough with the internet service providers. She wants them to crack down on web porn and some of the politically extremist stuff you can find on the internet.
The catalyst for this was Mark Bridger, who murdered 5-year-old April Jones and had a pretty horrific library of material, some of which was legal and just not very nice, and other stuff which was very illegal and horrific. Images of child abuse. This has pushed people to say, well, why is this stuff so easy to get online? There are two elements to this. One is the consumer web. Google, for example, is the web to most people. It's their starting point, the gateway to the internet. Google says that it does a lot of work removing, it can't block websites, but it can remove links to websites from its search index, so it's much less visible. It bases the removal of those links on work that is done by the Internet Watch Foundation. But we have discovered there's only 5 people at the Internet Watch Foundation working on this, and Google only gives them £20,000 a year. Facebook, £10,000 a year. So for a massive problem that Google, you know, waxes lyrical about, you know, its dedication to the cause, that's pathetic.
How much would it cost to do something? I mean, we're talking millions and millions of pounds here, well, to actually tackle this problem in any sort of fundamental
this
way.
This is the flip side of the thing, is that if you look beyond the easy consumer web, if you look at the dark web, people exchanging content on P2P file sharing sites, to find out what the material is that they're sharing, you would have to be doing very fine-grained analysis of that content. And you're looking basically at a system like they have in China. They have 100,000 people, it's estimated, monitoring content that is flowing through their networks, and they're still not controlling everything.
And big companies like Google have resisted this sort of pressure to take such a sort of micro approach to this sort of thing in the past.
Absolutely. There are very significant freedom of speech issues about that, and people quite rightly don't want their content to be analysed. But there must be a technological solution to this. As I have said publicly and written many times, look at the talent and the resources that these companies have at their disposal. They could and should be doing far more. And this is why Maria Miller is meeting with them. And it's interesting that hot on the heels of the tax issue, where these companies are feeling pressurised that they need to do something visible to be more engaged, this is an issue where they can really make a difference.
And a lot of the pressure has come, it has to be said, from the Daily Mail, which has made this really a sort of front page campaigning issue.
Yeah, they love this kind of stuff, don't they? And, you know, it's good. It's good for them. It's a good kind of campaigning human issue. So it fits very well with them. The wider picture is that, obviously don't like talking about this, especially because we're English, but the kind of sexy elephant in the room is porn of any variety at all. And all of the kind of legal entertainment industry behind that is as much as 25% of all web searches, to indicate how significant this is.
So a quarter of all web searches across the board are in some way porn-related?
Depending on the estimates, 15 to 25%, 25 at most. But when you walk into the lobby of Google's HQ in Silicon Valley, you see in real time Google searches that people are doing right now. And interestingly enough, I suspect that's slightly edited, not to show that 25% of searches.
Okay, well, we'll wait and see what Maria Miller asks of the companies and what they say in response. But despite that sort of critical mass of opinion and this idea that, yes, you've got freedom of speech on one hand, but you've got this sort of freedom from this hate material on the other, it feels like there's a long way to go before we see any sort of substantial movement, I think, on this from the ISPs.
It's an almost insolvable problem, not least because of the volume of content out there. And Mark Williams-Thomas, who is very well known as a child protection expert in this area.
And did the ITV Savile documentary.
He did the ITV Savile documentary, indeed. And he worked with CEOP, the Child Exploitation and Online Protection Unit, for years, has said that the software does exist to try and recognise, if not faces and people, then certainly locations that can try and identify people to get some prosecutions in this area. Even if they could identify every single person in this country who has either made, shared or distributed material showing child abuse, there's not enough space in our prisons and the criminal justice system couldn't cope. So there's a far bigger cultural and societal issue that needs to be addressed there, and this goes way beyond the internet industry itself.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Next up, Jemima, is Yahoo and Tumblr. Yahoo spent $1.1 billion on Tumblr last month. What's it going to do with it?
Yahoo has been trying to make itself a media company forever, and there are a few factors to this. One is that it's an interesting differentiator between Yahoo and Google, when Google has clearly got search nailed with a 60, 70, 80% market share in most significant markets. The other is about advertising, because Yahoo has traditionally been very strong in advertising, and the cool thing on the block now is native advertising, so really meaningfully embedded and targeted ads for a kind of cool user group, actually, is what they're buying with Tumblr. The stats are thought to be about 30 to 50 million active users a month, which is pretty healthy considering that those are users who, they're not fleeting users. People who have a Tumblr normally give it quite a lot of love.
And they're cool.
Apparently so. Well, they are at the moment. The thing is, the internet, as Rupert Murdoch discovered, is consumers are really fickle. So if the cool kids think that Yahoo isn't cool enough, and to many it's not because it represents, you know, a big kind of mainstream consumer audience and it's a bit tacky, frankly.
It's the 90s.
It's pretty 90s, isn't it? Then they're very likely to move on. And where would that be? Yahoo has said very clearly that it's going to let Tumblr carry on being independent and retain its cool, and it sort of has had to say that so that the cool kids will stay. But we shall wait and see.
A one-line answer, if you will, Jemima, but to save our listeners who are frantically Googling Tumblr now to find out what it is.
Yeah, well, don't put an E in it. That would be my first tip. Tumblr. It's halfway between an old-fashioned blog and Twitter, but often very visual, and it's very, very easy to post. So if you are writing a bit of, a gig review you've just been to, or you're filming a video, or you're recording some audio, you can then send it straight from your phone and post to your Tumblr.
And what are these rumours about another two-syllable?
Hulu.
Exactly. Thank
Hulu.
You.
Yahoo is rumoured to be bidding, and there are a few companies interested in Hulu, which is it's just in the US at the moment, but it's a TV, online TV catch-up service, which is quite cool. But the bidding is sort of edging up towards $1 billion now, and analysts are starting to say it's not really looking all that clever for Yahoo. Again, it will be an advertising play for them. But online TV, frankly, is a bit of a mess at the moment. There's huge demand, huge potential, but there's a lot of roadblocks from people like the smart TV manufacturers, broadcasters themselves. There's a confusion about where the centre of that TV experience is going to be. So it's a dangerous area for Yahoo to get into.
Too many platforms. You got, you know, Hulu in the US, you got Netflix, of course, then you got Amazon getting into it, and we got YouView, whatever that is.
It's really confusing for consumers. On top of that, you've also got smart TVs, which kind of seem to be the future and seem to make sense for consumers who are looking to upgrade their TVs. But the experience of the internet-powered apps is atrocious. Well, not to go into it too much, but there's a real estate war going on. Who controls that internet experience on your TV? And the manufacturers don't want to let any of these kind of internet content companies have too much control over that. So the experience at the moment is anything but smart.
Well, a topic we should return to in the future. And something else that isn't very smart is the clock on the BBC's online homepage.
Oh, God, this is so annoying. This is chronological correctness gone mad, I decided. This came from a complaint of somebody who uses the BBC website that the clock wasn't always right.
Like an old-fashioned kind of analogue clock that you used to get before schools,
yes,
programming.
A little picture of a clock on the website, which for some reason was then escalated to the BBC Trust's standard and committee rule, you know, was analysed by the, committee rules and fell foul of accuracy guidelines.
This is because the clock isn't always correct.
Because the clock isn't always correct. But the only time that clock would be incorrect was if the clock on the user's computer is incorrect. So
it's the user's fault, not the BBC's, is what you're saying.
Basically the user's fault. They can't, if when they're building a website, they can't power the clock from some central world clock.
Big Ben, for
because
instance.
We have this thing called time zones. So different people around the world. They can't geolocate you and then present your time because geolocation is notoriously inaccurate. So the easiest way to do it is to show the time that is showing on that computer. So some complete numpty has complained that the BBC clock is wrong.
And it's a sign of the seriousness with which the BBC takes these complaints. They've rolled over and said, yes, you're right.
No, it's also a sign of a lack of literacy in how websites are actually built and run.
Digital balls, you might say. They should have told him to stick his clock.
They should have told him to just correct the time on his computer, and that would have fixed the problem.
Maybe they could have complained to his editorial complaints unit.
Yes.
And before you go, Jemima, we did touch on this last week, but in your absence, much excitement, The Guardian's new coffee shop in Shoreditch, which I was hoping to come to tonight.
Yes.
Or last night, depending on when you're listening to this. Or last week.
Well, we have decided that this news business is a bit too risky, so we're not going to be a news organisation anymore. We're going to just open coffee shops around the world. Well, that's what you might have thought, I think, if you were reading Twitter. Actually, it's an experimental marketing project to engage people with The Guardian's content and to create a real-world kind of public space that represents The Guardian, which is an interesting idea in itself. So we're just trying it out. We're at Box Park in Shoreditch and we have a beautiful, beautifully designed space. We're working with local providers who have built some very beautiful furniture. Nude Espresso, who are a tiny startup in London. So we're working with local suppliers. It's a very interesting space. We're going to be doing all manner of editorially based projects in there, interviews and Stitch and Bitch and Meet the CEO.
Maybe even Media Talk.
Maybe even Media Talk. Well, we're definitely doing Tech Weekly there, so Media Talk as well, please. But it's an experimental space, so I can't really tell you what's going to happen in there. We're just going to try some stuff out, and why not? Because if you're not trying new stuff, then you're not doing it right, I think.
Excellent. Well, we shall experiment there very soon. Jemima Kish, as ever, thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure.
It's time to talk television now with The Guardian's TV editor, Rebecca Nicholson. I know, it's a Vicky Frost there. It was like a flashback.
It's a flashback to a former time. I think she's still definitely in Australia.
I hate flashbacks in TV drama. I always sort of inwardly sigh and occasionally outwardly sigh, especially in Mad Men when it goes back to Merlin lookalike.
Well, we've had 3 weeks of Mad Men flashbacks. Yeah. Well, flashbacks / drug-induced hallucinations. But they seem to be going heavy on it this season.
I can take enough of that.
I'm okay with it. I think we weren't going to talk about Mad Men, but let's talk about Mad Men.
Yeah, I've done it.
The last three episodes have been outstanding episodes. And I didn't expect that from the start of the series, which was quite slow. But I think Mad Men does tend to do that anyway. But three real crackers in a row. It's been great.
It's been a corker. Well on form. I vote it should get an Emmy.
I vote, that.
Two.
And a Golden Globe.
Yes. And a BAFTA.
All of them.
And together in a bag. But first up this week, all human life is about to be covered in the next 7.5 minutes. Because we start off with Game of Thrones, where it was a big week.
It was a huge week. I think the biggest week in its history. Even more of a shocker than that thing that happened at the end of the first series that was a big shocker. Yeah, I'm trying to do this without spoilers. I don't know if it's possible.
It's hard, isn't it?
It's really hard. But we can try and talk around it.
So big stuff happened.
Big stuff happened.
And it went mental on Twitter.
Well, I kind of just wanted to make sure everyone was okay because it was a very traumatic thing to do. As you know, the nature of the job means that often we watch TV in an office, which is a slightly strange viewing experience, but I had to watch this before it was broadcast in the office. And I just sat at my desk with my head in my hands, feeling really very distraught.
I get that watching Bake Off.
I got that a little bit watching Love and Marriage, which we'll discuss in a little while. People who read the books knew what was coming. This is an event called the Red Wedding, which you can probably guess that bad stuff happens. It's not just the colour of her dress. And so people who read the books knew it was coming. I have not read the books. I did not know it was coming. was quite a big cull of major cast members, and it was a real shock. And it was so gruesome. I think that's the way they did it really shocked people. And even by Game of Thrones standards, when you have a lot of gruesome things happening week on week, it was horrendous. So very upsetting. Twitter actually broke halfway through the UK transmission of that episode.
It broke Twitter.
I think it broke. I think the weight of people's tears probably broke Twitter.
I remember being very shocked when there was a massacre in a wedding in the Colbys, I think. I think I've got that right. Dynasty spin-off, yeah. Which I'm not sure you remember.
I never saw it.
But back then, I had no Twitter to go on to talk about it, so I just...
So what did you do? CB radio.
I think I chatted with my imaginary friend. But it turns out they'd... turns out she'd gone out. But Game of Thrones, one more episode next week, is
one
that right?
One more episode. If everyone's ready for it, if
but
people
it turns
feel like
out,
they can take it, because it's a lot to deal with.
It turns out it was all a dream. Next week, Twitter goes mad again. Okay, second up this week. Let's have a low and then end on a high. So I'm going to suggest we talk about Love and Marriage on
yes.
ITV.
It's unfortunate that it's a low because it's got a good cast. I tend to love anything Alison Steadman does. And she's good in this, but... This is an ITV drama, and it seems as if they've tried to make a cross between Last Tango in Halifax, which obviously did well, got the BAFTA, and there's a slight Modern Family element to it, in which the cast sit on sofas and can deliver a to-camera bit, and it just doesn't work at all. It kind of looks like an IKEA ad from 20 years ago. It's a really bizarre setup, and it really jars. It doesn't feel like it fits with this kind of comedy drama. It's a jaunty score, bumbling characters, and then a really sad, devastating thing happens, and the tone is just so off. It doesn't really know what it wants to be. And I think Last Tango in Halifax worked really well because they didn't really care that it was a drama about older people. They didn't try to make it appeal to everyone. They just made that drama and did it well. And everyone watched it as a result. But this one, it seems as if they've taken that and then tried to appeal to all age ranges. And it's diluted it. It's just very messy.
Feels like a drama by committee almost, or commission by committee.
Yeah, a dramedy.
A dramedy.
A comma. Yeah.
And so it's part docu-soap and part kind of just traditional drama, but...
Well, sort of.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a real mess. It doesn't know what it wants to be. I think it's a waste of a good cast as well. So there are hints that it's got potential, but I think it needs to really sort itself out and drop this to camera business. No need for it.
Well, much more exciting, and also on ITV... To reassure all employees and enormous fans of ITV listening, there was a fantastic new drama, which is a bought-in drama, has to be said, from America, called The Americans,
yes.
Appropriately enough.
I have been on the hunt for a new homeland since season two finished, and I think this may well
one finished,
be...
Frankly. Yeah.
Well, I would argue that it's perhaps even less subtle than Homeland season two, which is saying something.
It's a crowd pleaser, isn't
it's
it?
A crowd pleaser, but I really enjoyed it. It's big. A lot happens. I like that they open with a big bombastic kidnapping to the strains of Fleetwood Mac's Tusk, which is deranged anyway. And it just kind of ramps up the tension. It keeps the tension going, and it does it well. And that's what I liked so much about Homeland, is that you spend half of it, again, kind of watching the TV from behind the cushion, and, you know, you don't know what's going to happen when. And I felt like that with this. There's a scene when the FBI agent is searching.
Well, we should sum up quickly before he tells that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The setting is two
undercover... I've just assumed that everyone's watched it. You don't need to know, yeah. Do you want to sum up?
Well, that's it. So The Americans, it's a drama, the elevator pitch coming up. So two undercover Soviet agents living in America, pretending to be Americans. They got a couple of kids, perfect home life. But it turns out, in fact, they are occasional killers and spying on all and sundry. And guess what? Only an FBI chap comes and moves in next door. So has he been sent there? Does he know they're undercover? Or is it just a flipping great coincidence?
Who knows?
But in the meantime, the bodies pile up. All sorts of badness goes on.
There's lots of skulking around.
And there's Phil Collins in the air tonight.
And yeah, Phil Collins.
Because it's set in 1981.
So, I mean, you need that there, really. It's
Rebecca Nicholson, over to you. So your highlight was, you were going to tell me.
Well, not so much a highlight, it's just an example of the way they do tension well. FBI agent searching the boot of the car in which, for many days, they'd held a prisoner and just got rid of him. And that's all very tense. And then KGB spy husband is actually skulking around the corner with a pistol. And that bit I was cushion up. Very tense.
I was
but
almost
it does it well.
Cheering at the screen, but
yeah.
It was quite late on a Saturday night.
It was very late. Your neighbours might have had complaints.
I'm pretending I watched it live and wasn't actually in bed at that time. Watched it the next day. No, it's very good, I think. I'm very excited about episode two. So, you know, who thought that? A must-see US drama on ITV. These things don't always go together.
No.
And Matthew Rhys was good, but his partner in crime, Kerry Russell, even better.
Well, I think she's got a slightly more developed character. She's, in the first episode, Matthew Rhys's character wavers slightly on his allegiance to the motherland, but she very much doesn't. And she gets a couple of the funniest scenes in which their kids come home from school full of worries about the Red Menace and how inferior Russia is to the US. And you can see her bristling, and that provided a bit of levity, which I thought was very good. She's great.
And my one complaint was Matthew Rhys's character's use of the word medal as a verb when he was talking about some Olympics tomfoolery.
Is that an American thing?
Well, I think, you know, back in 1981, 31 years ago, I'm not sure it had evolved.
Oh, I see.
The controversial route evolution from noun to verb,
yeah.
I think was, you know, hadn't even begun.
And I watched it with a Russian, and apparently they wouldn't have knocked back the shot of vodka in bed. They would have sipped it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, producers, if you're listening, not too late to change it for the DVD. Well, that's all for this week. My thanks to Rebecca Nicholson.
Thank you very much.
And to all our guests, who were Lisa Campbell, Jason Deans, and Jemima Kish. You can have your say on this week's show on our Facebook wall or our blog, or you can tweet me at JohnPlunkett149. Come on, you know you want to. Media Talk is produced by Mr. Matt Hill. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.